commercial ethics. And I said we'd get back to continuing the conversation today. And basically the rule of thumb which we established is that one is not allowed to lie on concerning something, but one doesn't necessarily have to volunteer all the truth unless one is asked point blank. Another principle which we discussed is what determines the law. Is the law determined by what the book says or by what is considered to be acceptable common practice, even if it's not precisely according to the book? With respect, of course, secular law is different than religious law, because in religious law, we assume that, you know, even if nobody catches you or nobody cares what you're doing, nevertheless, you are culpable and liable for whatever you do. But secular law is based actually on what the state enforces, not on what the not on what strictly speaking is on the book. There are a couple of other principles which we have to be aware of. Another principle which is important is you are not allowed to steal from a non-Jew. You're not theft from a non-Jew is forbidden. However, there's no responsibility upon you to pay back a loan unless he actually demands it of you. This is a very interesting concept. We have the question: why do you have to repay a loan which you get from another Jew?
He gave you the money.
What?
He gave you the money.
So what? So he gave it to me.
Brother.
What? So what? I don't. But my family never pays me back any money they take from me.
Your son will pay you back. Don't
what?
Your son will pay you back.
You really? I'm not gonna hold my breath. So what is the basis for it?
You made an agreement for him.
What binds me to keep my agreement?
Shtar.
So most loans are not done by Shtar.
No. It's your word.
What?
Your word.
It's my word.
So the Shtar, you have to do what you say.
What does it say?
You have to say the words that come out of your mouth, you have to do. Like
yeah, but that's not about where you took a nether. It's about where you
vowed. This is without a nether.
This is without a nether. So this actually is an issue which is grappled with a great deal by the major sources. There is, Rav Shimon Shkop says there is a lot, that it's logical. You don't have to have a source in the Torah to pay people back. You know, that's the logic. It's the concept of the social contract. When I take money from when I borrow from you, it makes sense that I have to return it. But it's not so simple to say that, because the Gemara in Ksuvus, and I think somewhere else also says, that the reason that the paying back your lien holder, somebody from whom you borrowed money, is a mitzvah. It says, priyas v'achov, paying that person back is a mitzvah. And it's learned out in some convoluted way from a pasuk in Torah, which talks about proper weights and measurements. And it says that, just like so it says, proper weights and measurements, when you say something, you're supposed to say, be proper in what you say. So, but it understood in that context, we understand if priyas v'achov is a mitzvah, to pay back your lien holder is a mitzvah, so that mitzvah might not necessarily apply to a non-Jew. Now, if he comes and demands it from you, of course, you have to give it back to him. It's his money. But if he doesn't demand it of you, as long as he doesn't come to demand it of you, you can retain it. You don't have to actually give it to him.
Is that true of objects also?
What?
If you borrow an object from a non-Jew, and then he totally forgets about it and never asks you for it?
Right, because there's no mitzvah hashavas aveda, per se. Right. Now, I'm not talking about the Kiddush Hashem factor. Of course, if you can make the Kiddush Hashem, you sanctify God's name by paying back a loan or by returning a lost object. That's a wonderful thing. But we're talking about here, according to the strict letter of the law, without taking Kiddush Hashem into account, and also, of course, without taking Kiddush Hashem, the desecration of God's name, into account, meaning that if what you're doing is going to cause everybody to think of Jews in a low and base way, so then you're certainly not allowed to do that. But again, getting back to our babysitter or nanny problem, right? So people certainly don't think of other people who hire nannies off the books in a negative way, because everybody does it. I shouldn't say everybody. A high percentage of the population. He doesn't. But a high percentage of the population
I
does.
Don't actually.
What?
I don't actually.
I know, you told me.
Oh,
you mentioned
it. I
said
I do it.
No, you don't. So high percentage of the population does, including, you know, very distinguished civil servants. So therefore, a Kiddush Hashem issue doesn't exist, or at least hopefully doesn't exist. So rather, what we're dealing with here is the question of whether you're allowed to refrain from paying the government money which they don't demand from you. And the answer is yes. If the government doesn't demand money from you, you're not required to pay them the money. Yeah.
So then, is Orsamed going to offer lifetime enrollment to students so that they can defer student loans forever?
Well, actually, I heard
I'm deferring mine for a year and a half.
Okay, you're not good enough.
I actually deferred my student loan for about 20 years. And I actually heard once, I don't know if it's true, and I guess you should assume it's not true because it would be to reflect pretty badly, but I heard there are certain institutions where teachers are enrolled as students for their entire lives, and they keep on taking student loans out, and they never pay them back. There's no distinction made between teacher and student in these places, and that basically becomes part of their salary. So I don't know if that's true or not true. Let's assume it's not, but it's an interesting idea. But hypothetically, if you're really a student, you can do that. But if you're not really a student, then at some point there's going to be some lie committed by somebody. Or someone's going to lie that you're on the books, putting you on the books even though you're not. You're going to lie to your student even though you're not. Somebody's going to be lying somewhere. Isn't that going to be the case?
So, say for example, a student comes up to you a week and every month for the...
becomes a question of a legal loophole. It's not a question of halacha anymore. In other words, halacha is, halacha says you can't lie. You don't have to pay money, you don't have to volunteer money, but you can't lie on a form, and if you submit a form, it has to be truthful. So therefore, the question is now what legal loopholes you can take advantage of in the American system, not in the Jewish system.
So if I went and, after my degree, decided to go on University of Phoenix online and get a degree in the easiest degree possible there, so I only have to like really do it like 15 minutes a day, and I can get the degree and take like a 4-year degree there just to defer my loan.
You'll be foolish because it's very expensive at the University of Phoenix.
But hypothetically.
Or any online degree.
All those online degrees are very expensive. So you actually lose money in the bargain.
Yeah, James Cook University of Australia is not so expensive.
But that you can't get through the loan at the University
of Australia. So what's the topic about the nuances?
So the I think the University of South Africa is the most easiest way to get a...
South Africa is actually the biggest university in the world, just so you know.
Huge. Huge.
Yeah. All the students go all over the world, right?
It's,
we send you our rejects, and we have a lot of rejects, so we have a big university.
We have a lot of rejects.
I just sent them an email asking how to get into their doctoral program. I have a book on Tanakh. So I'm choking. So I figured, you know, I'll translate it to English. I'll use it as a thesis, and I get a degree as an Old Testament.
Nice.
So I haven't gotten a response from them yet, but I'm waiting to see what they say. So in any event, so that you can't actually lie. You don't have to repay until you're asked. Now, those are two basic principles. And the third basic principle we mentioned was that also the bar is set by what is demanded of you, not by what it says on the book. So now let's go to file sharing. Once upon a time, in the days of the cassette era, which is, your children someday will ask you what cassettes were. In the day when cassettes were actually the common form of storing music and such like, so the generally accepted psak in the Jewish world was, the halachic world, was that if you would not buy a tape for the song which you wanted, you just make do without it. And therefore, you're not actually getting tangible benefit from, tangible is one word, you're not actually saving money by copying somebody else's tape or music, so then it would be permissible to do so without pay. However, if you're doing it in order to save money, because you indeed really want this tape or this music, and you're just doing it in order to circumvent the system and not pay, then you have to pay.
Why?
What if there are laws against it?
Why? Because it's an accepted practice to do that. And so what's the problem?
Because there's a special halacha, which is that if I have tangible benefit from you, and again, tangible is the wrong word, if I have an identifiable benefit from you, I must pay you for it. In halacha, there's another example of that is, let's say you were a lawyer, right? Mm-hmm. And I came to you and I came, you know, after accident, so sometime in the evening, some day, and said, Ron, can you give me advice? I have this issue here going on, and we have a discussion for 20 minutes or so. So later on, you could send me a bill for those 20 minutes. You know, you can go send me a bill, okay, you charge $600 an hour, you could charge me for that, whatever, what's the third of that? $200. The same thing if you're a doctor. If I come to you as a doctor and I say, listen, Ron, if you don't know my good friend, can I consult you on this issue? I have this blister or whatever, and you talk to me for about it, and I may be even treated. So then you can later send me a bill, even though I didn't agree to ahead of time. Mm-hmm. But it's implicit in my consulting a doctor that is professional. That's what he does. So his time is worth money. The same thing if a person is an artist and they make music, they're an entertainer. That's how they make money, by selling their wares. If it's something where you otherwise would have bought it, so you're deriving a benefit from them which is worth money, which you therefore should pay for. Do you see the barrel?
Well, that would be true today, so it should be against law. Even if it was accepted practice, it should be illegal to download a single song, because now they have those things where you can download any song you want for $1 a piece.
Right.
So if you're willing to pay $1 for that song, then you should never download them for free.
Right.
But you think if you wouldn't pay for it?
What?
If you wouldn't
pay $1 for it, then you could download it for free.
But how about the law that explicitly...
No, I'm telling you that one thing. Mm-hmm.
The whole idea of putting a song on the radio is to promote the TV. So there's a certain song that you...
Is that true? I don't think it's true. I think people who get paid... I think radio stations have to pay royalties every time they pay somebody's song.
No, it's true. However, if you're listening to a song on the radio... from a certain artist, and it's only one song, and there are 12 songs on the CD, and you really like that song. The whole point of you of them actually releasing that only one song, because why doesn't an artist usually release more than 3 songs per album? Usually. The reason is because they send those as advertisements to the CD.
Radio stations only have to play like 3.
That's not that. The artist it takes money to release your song from an album. Right, until you give it to the radio, I don't know exactly how it works. But in other words, if no artist actually sells all his CDs, plus all the songs from an album. They only usually make the most 3, maybe 4, and then you have to assume that if one of the songs or two of the songs are good, the rest of the CD is good.
It's usually
basically,
one.
You're going to be buying the whole CD just basing on that one song.
Okay.
So basically, if you're just copying that one song, you're not going to be buying that whole CD. But the whole point is, just because you like that...
No, but many people buy old CDs just for one song, don't they?
Yeah.
And especially nowadays, you know, once upon a time you can make the argument, this goes back to what Ron said a moment ago, once upon a time you can make an argument and say, you know, this group, they only have really one good song, the rest of the record stinks, I would never buy it for this one song, so I'm just going to record this one song. But nowadays, that one song is probably downloadable on the internet for $1 or $2, whatever it is. Right? So therefore, you should, nowadays, that individual songs can be downloaded, there's more of a reason to obligate you to pay.
That's the thing, when in the world of cassettes, and when we would copy, someone had an album or whatever, you would copy it, it was done very much on, for lack of a better word, on a retail basis.
Mm-hmm.
With the internet and downloading of songs, all of a sudden I realized my kids were downloading thousands of songs. I mean, they have the capability to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, I recognized that what they were doing was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But for a long time, they were doing it. I had no... It just, the technology moved faster than my understanding of it.
It moved faster than the law, too.
Exactly. And I think at some point, there's a distinction. There's a distinction because you could see it in the marketplace. You could see record sales... I'm showing my age. CD sales were dropping off. Okay, you could see that there was being a tangible impact. When we were kids and we were buying albums all the time, and you had an album I really loved, and I made a cassette of it or something, that wasn't affecting record sales. It was done on a very, very small basis. This is on a whole different scale.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sometimes scale impacts...
Right. I think in this case what happened was, I agree with you, and I'd like to take it a bit a step further and say that the scale is what caused the artists and the companies to start being, the Hebrew word is machzir, I'm not sure how to
strip
such as a
strip
that on the individual song.
Even if it was the record company's fault. Like, personally, I look at the decline of the music industry, I say good riddance to bad rubbish. Back in the day, I could buy a tape.
What does that mean in English?
That means you're getting old.
I could buy a tape for, say, I don't remember what it was, say 20 rand, say $4.
Okay. That was a long time ago. I think that was before you were born.
Make your
maybe South Africa or something like that, yeah.
I'll make your figures, and I'll go buy a blank tape for $3. Nowadays, when I first bought my first CD, I remember CDs were hell of an expensive. You know, new technology came to South Africa, like one out of every 57 households had a CD player. It was a big thing. I paid, I think, 50 rand or 60 rand for a CD. So divide that by 3.5 and you have your dollar price, right?
This is only 3 years ago, right?
And that was it. You never had a choice. Now I know that I can buy a blank CD for, in American cents, probably not much.
About
10 cents a CD. I know that the record company is paying even less for it. And I know that they're charging me 3 times as much for the CD, even though inflation has been 6%.
Yeah, but that's the beautiful thing about capitalism. It doesn't matter because the size of the market will bear.
No, but this is capitalism. They went and
no, you're not being capitalist. You're opting out of the capitalism.
No, they passed themselves out of the market. And so to do that, people started buying from the internet. If they were to drop their prices to normal prices, people would say, you know what, Darren, now being fair, instead of downloading from the internet, I'll go back to buying the CD.
And that's
they shot themselves in.
I think
people got addicted to stealing. And my kids were stealing, and they didn't realize it. And I stopped it. And I told them they couldn't do it anymore, and they had to take Napster off their computers, and they couldn't do it. I mean, it's just because it is. We don't call it that, but it is. It's stealing. It's like they walked in the record store and they stole some CDs. I kind of never consciously done that, but that's what they were doing. They were downloading thousands of songs.
What if somebody, though, gives you their CD? They buy a CD and it's file sharing. There's no hard.
They can retain the CD. The same thing with software.
Right.
Good point. I didn't discuss that yet. Software.
Is a song within the software, or
the bit pattern of the information is considered property?
Exactly.
Meaning that if you give someone your CD to borrow, you have to make sure that you don't. Even if you have a copy, you can even have a copy at home, but you cannot listen to your copy as long as they have your CD.
And I don't know if they changed the law did they make this law in accordance with this stuff? Or
no, I think it's halakhically. I think it's like you can't, if you let someone borrow your CD and you still listen to a copy of it, then basically they should have bought the CD if they like it so much.
No, because on all CDs it says, I guess you delete the copy within 30 days, which would mean that you have 30 days.
Really? 30 days?
Really?
30
I've never seen
that.
That's big lenience.
I've never seen that.
The idea I'm getting at is that if you were sharing, because it was called song share, and I don't do it, I don't listen to that much music, but the fact is that if people were transferring information, you know, what if I download some information off the internet, some writing, and I start handing it out?
Well, if it's there for that. free, if it's public domain, you're fine. But if not, it's
I'm stealing it from the radio.
If they could get
But in the abstract, they're broadcasting publicly.
In the abstract, we're not. But if you would prevent, you could pay them the dollar, so that they would have the same problem anyway.
Wait, hold on, right. So you asked my question about the laws. You're going to get that? If there are laws specifically stating that you can't do it,
no, yeah, I'm trying to.
You're gonna get that, right? Yeah. Okay.
Okay. You know, they used to.
I don't know if you like to get that.
They used to say in Israel. How many people here speak Hebrew? Okay. So they used to be saying in Israel, "Am echad, disk echad." One nation, one disk. To go from hand to hand. That is an unfortunate statement, but it used to be true. I think now it's less true. I think people have gotten into the mode of paying for software at this point, but it used to be, at the beginning, when software was first came out, so nobody felt, it's just that. It's just a program. What's the difference? But nowadays, I think people understand, since Microsoft is very meticulous about this, that this is something which you cannot do. Now, it's interesting. On a tape, let's compare cassettes to software for a minute. On a cassette tape, very often they print on the cassette tape, in Jewish tapes, they say, it's forbidden to copy this tape. Anybody who does so is a transgressing theft, right? Have you ever seen that?
Yeah.
Okay, especially on Jewish tapes, you do that.
Seen it in a book, too.
On a software, I think it's in an article. On a software, it says that if you open this envelope, which holds the software, you are binding yourself by the agreement, which is, that you're not going to copy it or reproduce it, whatever the case may be. There's a very big difference between the two, halakhically. Probably not legally, but halakhically there is. Which is, when I buy the tape, and I open it up, and I see those letters on the tape, I didn't agree to that condition. The seller didn't come to me and say, when I buy it in Tuvia's, let's say, Tuvia himself, can you imagine that? Tuvia himself doesn't come to me and say, listen, Beckhoffer, if you buy this tape, you're not allowed to copy it. Somebody printed that on a tape many stages ago. I don't accept that agreement upon myself. The fact that I bought the book or the CD doesn't bind me to that. But the software companies have devised this ingenious solution to that problem, which is, or I don't know if they took our love into account, which is when you open the package, they say, you don't have to open the package, return this us unopened, we'll refund your money. If you open the package, if you do that maisa, that deed of opening the package, then you're accepting the agreement upon yourself. So there's a basic difference between those two. If the agreement on the software says no copying and you open it up, there's no excuse whatsoever in the world to copy it. No excuse. You accept the agreement by doing that maisa, the deed of opening it up. If you have a cassette, then it goes back to the principles we spoke about before. If it is the type of industry, such as perhaps the Jewish music industry, where things are not downloadable like they are in the general industry. What?
Yeah, you know how to get them.
No, not downloadable for money. I'm saying you don't
want
them.
For money.
So that it's possible still to adhere to the old standard that, well, for one or two songs, I wouldn't buy it, and therefore I can copy those one or two songs and not have to worry about paying for it. But in the case of the software, that does not apply. If the software even could copy, at all, would be forbidden. Now, in terms of the article book, also, when I buy this book, so it says here, again, as we mentioned last time, it says, on the penalty of death, you cannot copy this. No file's volume may be reduced in any form, photocopy, electronic media, otherwise even for personal study group, or you classroom use without written permission from the copyright holder, etc. They're very strict about this. If you call art school, they'll put all sorts of restrictions upon you. For example, let's say you are an orphaner, and you are doing kiruv in the Jewish community. You are one of the most outstanding, altruistic Jewish organizations in the world. Tough luck, right? You want to use art school, you buy it. What they might let you do is if you need to have photocopies for a limited date for Shabbaton or something, they'll let you have a copy, like one for every two people, not that everybody should have a copy, and make sure that afterwards you collect it and take back all the copies which you gave out. Right? So make sure nobody chas v'shalom gets away with having taken this. So this is a very stringent standard, and I don't believe that actually one has to adhere to that standard precisely for several reasons. One, by the way, disclaimer, I used to work for Oscar, I don't anymore. So if I were working for Oscar, I might not be as free about this, but I'm not. First of all, if you just are photocopying this chumash because it's convenient, and you would have just as well taken one of the old chumashim, which is offset from the 1800s, which is not copyright protected, right, and use the same chumash, it's just that this one is the one of the Beit Medrash, then there's no reason for you not to be allowed to do so according to halacha, right? Because this actually is, so you're not doing it to enjoy their specific labor. You're doing it because it's the convenient chumash.
That's English.
No, no, no. I'm saying just the chumash part of it, not the English part of it, right? The which is an important distinction. So if you're doing it for the chumash part, then it's not for the English. And again, the recent fact that they had this old claim in the beginning, when I bought it, I didn't necessarily agree to that. Nobody was nobody told me at the point of sale that I have to agree to this in order to buy the book. Doesn't say it on any package, which I have to open. So therefore, if it's the type of thing where I could use any book, I'm just using this for convenience, it also is permissible. Or it's permissible. Also, were it to be the type of use, although with our school this is not so so simple to assume, but were it the type of use which you know they would not go after you. For example, you have in libraries all over the world photocopying machines. And we know people photocopy far more material than the copyright laws allow them to copy. Right? They have signs in certain places to avoid lawsuits about the limitations of copying, but nobody cares, and everybody knows what's going on in the library. So, but clearly, the companies who produce these materials, by virtue of their not coming after all the libraries and saying, you must have strict limitations and adhere to them in place, there's a certain amount, a reasonable amount of copying, even above and beyond what you would expect, which people are entitled to do. Otherwise, there'd be no art school book anywhere library in the world. So therefore, for personal use, where it's not something which you would have bought anyway, just the convenience, and outside of being about the English part, to a limited extent, then I also believe it's permissible to do so, even though they have this warning at the beginning. Yeah?
What about words, lectures? For example, if I was to record you right now and put it on the internet and say, you know, anyone can download and listen to it.
It's a fascinating Gemara. I'm glad you brought that up. Actually, it's a set. Let me see if I can find it quickly.
Or some math will come after you, not really. Because they pay him, so.
I don't know. Oh, well, yeah, I recall
they
don't have like, there's lectures on age, and then there are a bunch
they
of other
them.
They sell them, right. And you can also download some for free,
right.
But there are other websites that you don't have to pay for, and you can, like, you different rabbis, you can just download all their stuff.
They put it on there.
They do it themselves.
Well, that's what I'm wondering. I don't know.
For instance, Rabbi Hopper,
I can assume that these lectures are okay. Because
some
of them aren't very good. The sound quality is really bad. Like, if this is someone who's just taking
anything I say, you can distribute as freely as possible. That's why.
But isn't it a source of math to decide that
free stuff?
Why, they hire some math.
What?
They hire you.
Whatever I say, they hire me to come to Shir, but not with what I count is what I say.
Is it, let's say, ever, if you have a CD and someone says, can I borrow it, and you're pretty sure that they're going to copy it before they borrow it?
It might be. But you don't have to assume it. Listen to the, let's see if I can. This is a Gemara, which discusses, concept actually, which discusses theft. Yeah, there it is. It says an amazing thing here. You have to understand exactly what it means. But it says, it talks about how theft is a bad thing. It says, but let's say I stole from another rabbi. Chaver here is a Talmud Chacham, a sage. I stole from him. And I go and say over his Torah, meaning you go out today, you take my lecture, you steal it, you go and say it over in your own name, you don't publish it in your own name, right? You're stealing my Torah. So it says, Afopi Shenikra Ganov, even though he's called a thief, Zocher Atzmo, I'm not sure, translate Zocher here, he has acquired for himself. In other words, he has done something which can be considered to be laudable. As it says, of course, of reverse in Mishlei, in Proverbs, which seems to be applicable specifically to the situation, Loya Bozu Lagano Kigno, they will not denigrate a thief when he steals. So speaking specifically about stealing words of Torah. And so, and in the final analysis, this person who goes around stealing Torah, Shemismana Panasal Sibri is going to become a leader of the community, Mizbakis the Rabbin, and he's going to bring merit to the masses, Vizokel Asno, and he's going to bring merit to himself. However, it says, Umshalom Ashiyadu, he will pay for that which is in his hand. Shinema says, Nimso Yishalom. It says, if he's found in his hand, then he will pay for what he has, for what he took. It's a very cryptic Tosefta. On the one hand, it seems to be encouraging stealing Torah and saying you're going to be merit all sorts of wonderful things happen to you. On the other hand, it says, but you are still liable I think the idea is that if a person is really so fervently driven to study and teach Torah that he's willing to steal Torah for that purpose, that shows that he has a really, really, you know, ambitious, Torah ambitious personality. And that's why he's such a wonderful person. But on the other hand, it's still nevertheless considered to be something which is not completely proper. So there's two aspects to it, both positive and negative.
If he steals the words and the ideas, that's one thing. If he steals the book, that's another.
Right. The words and ideas are different. And specifically Torah, the theme. There's a response of the Tzitz Eliezer, one of the great rabbis of the 20th century, still alive, very, very old man, and he was asked I don't know exactly who asked him the question, but one medical student asked him if he could steal an article from a journal and publish it in his own name, get a job or get recognition.
Get arrested.
So he said it is forbidden to do so. It specifically matters, I think, if I recall correctly. I shouldn't say a fan, because I haven't looked up, but if I recall correctly, I think he distinguished between Torah and everything else. It's a unique loophole by Torah, because he wants people to learn as much Torah as possible, so therefore he said, no, on the contrary, no, now I remember. He said by medicine you could do it too. By medicine you could also do it, because by medicine, like by Torah, we have a vested interest that as many people have access to the knowledge as possible. Because there's a Gemara which says by Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Yochanan once went to one of the Amoraim once went to a woman who was a doctor, a real doctor, witch doctor, or whatever, and got a certain type of medication. And she made him promise that he wouldn't reveal the secret to anybody, and he promised. And the next day, he went to shul on Shabbos and publicly broadcast the medication, you know, how you put it together. And the understanding was that a doctor is not allowed to keep life-saving knowledge to themselves. On the contrary, must be shared as much as possible. So I think actually he did say that in the case of the medical journal, you are allowed to disseminate the information. And it's like Torah in that respect. Yes?
So then what does our scroll say to that? I mean, is it kosher to take the our scroll so much and completely lift all the copyrighted English portions and reproduce it in the other book?
Copy, paste, republish.
Yes. But I don't know what Artsville does with this Osefta. I assume what they would say is that that's true about the written word, that you would be able to take what I say verbally and go pass it on to somebody else in your own name. That would be permissible, but not to actually physically reproduce it. And
what about the Artsville tapes? They also say the same thing. The audio tapes, the Shira.
There are Artsville tapes.
They sell audio tapes of Shira with the rabbis. And I've seen in the yeshiva, there's a set of from some rabbi, I forget which, and on the tape, they're forbidden to copy this.
Yeah.
Versus other websites I've seen where they say, like, copy as much as you possibly
yeah,
can.
Yeah, I guess also they would say that for you, if you want to go and deliver the contents of the Shira yourself,
right,
then that would be okay. And that question would be okay. But not to copy the tape and disseminate it.
Couldn't we also be talking about, like, let's say you
that's an interesting point. Let me reiterate that. I think Artsville would tell you if you want to take if you want to take whatever it says in the on the tape and repeat it word for word in your own name onto another tape and then sell that tape, then you'd be within your right to do so. That receptor would give you permission, but not necessarily not that I should be able to duplicate your tape and then distribute it on my behalf. That would be the distinction.
What if you do it by accident? What if you back to the CD thing? What if your friend buys a CD and he copies it, gives it to somebody else, and you get it from somebody else, not even realizing that, you know, the circle. I guess maybe it's possible to realize that any copy is wrong. But what if you didn't even know the law?
You know, it's a law, it's not an excuse, I thought.
I mean, does it matter U.S. or does it matter?
Is it a Torah halakha not to copy the CD, or is it just because the U.S. halakha?
It becomes a form of theft. If the government forbids it, it becomes a form of theft.
The law, Rabbi, it's not even fair if you don't. If you break open the seal, you accept, blah, 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 blah. And then all you go and someone does it, and they break the law. I'm admitting that. They break the law. They give it to someone else, and that guy breaks the law by accepting it. But as you break the law by accepting this, is only the guy who's giving you a break the law by
doesn't break the law.
Huh? Okay, but now, the second guy who has it never opened a seal. Can he give it to a third guy, to a fourth guy, and so on and so on and so on? The because none of them agreed to that agreement.
No, because Kremlin couldn't have affected the copy in the first place. He was accepting stolen goods.
Even the third guy.
What?
The
they're all accepting stolen goods.
What? The third guy
is got
it
the only way. The way to ask the question is the other way around. If less guys, each guy passes the next guy the original CD, and each guy retains the copy.
I'm thinking about the original CD.
So they're passing on the original, keeping the copy.
No, there's no copies. There's no copies. He buys the CD, breaks the seal, puts the info into his computer, gives me the CD. I put the info into my computer, give him the CD, he puts the info into his computer, gives him the CD. So none of us, from me onwards, none of us have agreed to that.
What if you pay the person?
It doesn't matter. First of all, the seal issue is only a question, if we know the law is not enforced. But in this case, we know by software, generally speaking, the law is enforced. So therefore, I don't think it'll help you out in this case. But besides that, when you receive a disc from somebody else, by virtue of your having received the disc, as opposed to buying it, you've already done something wrong.
What if you buy it from that person?
Then I think they're allowed to sell it if they don't retain a copy.
But they don't retain a copy.
Yeah, but that's, again, that's war. What?
What if receiving stolen goods, what if somebody is selling you goods, they pretend they have the copyright, they're doing everything to make the buyer believe that what they're doing is legal, when in fact they're not?
So unless you find out, look, what are you supposed to do? If you never find out.
Yeah, someone buys software and then puts a copy on their computer, then sells it to someone else and I buy it. All I know is that he's selling me, for all I know, he followed the law and deleted his copy.
Right.
But so only he's doing something wrong because he's keeping a copy, which is wrong. But me buying it from him is not necessarily
That's
wrong.
That's correct. Yes.
Is there a way to justify some programs I know that are most design programs are super expensive, and for students, nearly impossible to afford that kind of stuff. Is it okay to download it, and then when you're actually going to become a professional and use it, buy a copy when you can actually afford it?
For Denver,
like Microsoft Office.
No.
Office is $300.
Everybody
has
options. But usually what you can do is usually there are demos. You should constantly get demos.
Sometimes they have a student edition that's $90.
What if they're ripping you off? What if they're extorting you?
Usually in a capitalistic society, if somebody's ripping you off, somebody else will produce the product for cheaper and you'll be able to get the alternative.
What if they patent it?
There was many ways to get around patents. In other words, in terms of software, unlikely that. For every program which costs hundreds or thousands of dollars, there's a shareware program which costs $40. Right? Usually that's the case, I believe.
I was thinking of CAD programs for designing things.
That's
ridiculously expensive, tens of thousands of dollars. And I wanted to try to use one. I couldn't even find a place where I was able to try to use it. I couldn't find it.
Download it free, of course.
Yeah,
try it out.
Yeah, can you do that? Let's say there's a software program that costs $100, and there's no demo. Can I download an illegal copy to try it out for a week, and then if I like it, buy it, and if I don't, delete it? Or is that also wrong?
It's hard to say, because, again, the question is, how stringent the company, whatever company it is, would be under those circumstances. Is that something which is commonly done? I don't know. I've never done that. That's something which is commonly done. People do it all the time, and it's considered okay by the world. So then I think it would be okay. But it's a very hard judgment call to make. It's best for her on the side of being more ethical than less ethical.
So let's say someone transgressed and downloaded a song that was free off the web. So they have the song there. So then should they delete the song, or is it considered it doesn't matter anymore because they're not going to buy
the song
and buy it and then download it again? Even if it's the same information?
Yeah.
Can't you just send a dollar to the artist or something?
Good luck, yeah, try. It can work.
What if they can't find the artist? What if it's a song, in Kazaa or Napster, there's a lot of songs that there used to be that are from no name, who knows where,
there's no
just not, there might be a copyright, but you have no idea who these people are. You have no clue what the CD is or what it's called.
Well, if there are no CDs available from these people, then I guess it would be okay. I mean, it's hard to, It's hard to say when you once you get to the periphery of the industry what exactly is considered to be still legitimate and what's not. It's a whole very gray area.
You can share on up to five.
I have to tell you, there's really not something which it's really not something which one is supposed to say over North America. I'm going to say it anyway, which is that several months ago, I wanted to publish an article. I wanted to publish a letter to the editor, not even under my name, in a certain magazine about racism in the Orthodox community. And what a bad thing it is. And this magazine eventually nixed the article. They nixed the letter. They would not publish it. And I spoke to the head of the editorial board of this magazine, and he said to me, there's certain things which we won't publish because they won't do any good, and therefore it's not worthwhile publishing about them because it just washes our very linen in public. And he said, another case in point from his perspective, and I was shocked to hear this, and I think it's something that has to be repudiated very strongly, he said, I don't like publishing articles about business ethics. He said, now, of course, I hold it's wrong to steal from non-Jews, and it's not ethical, and it's improper, and one cannot do it. But I know that there are people who rationalize this, and I understand where they're coming from, how they justify themselves. That's something to do with some convoluted logic that since the non-Jews perpetrated the Holocaust on us, so therefore we can steal from them as much as we possibly want. Therefore, he said, I'm not going to publish articles on the topic of business ethics because I know it's not going to work because nobody's going to listen to me anyway. So that's, again, I was shocked at the time.
What
was the actually saying? I'm not going to say which magazine it is. That's a well-known Jewish magazine. Further than that, I'm not going to go because I still like publishing there. That's something which is a big problem, and one has to be aware that there's a problem out there. And so, we have many Jews sitting in minimum security prisons learning about Yomi because they're willing to, cheat and skim off and do other things of that sort. And the Gemara in the Yerushalmi says, it's important Yerushalmi to know, my favorite Yerushalmi, the two Talmuds, the Bavli, which is Babylonian Talmud, which we study usually, and the Yerushalmi, which is not studied as often, but is also a part of the Talmudic literature. It brings down a story of Rabbi Shimon ben Shetach. Rabbi Shimon ben Shetach was one of the great sages of the Mishnah period, early Mishnah period, and he was very poor. And it happened one day that his students decided, in order to give him a living, they're going to buy him a donkey. And with this donkey, he's going to establish the Shimon ben Shetach Rent-a-Donkey Company. And then when he rents a donkey, so that then he's going to be able to make a living. So they bought him the donkey, and as they bring the donkey back to the Shimon ben Shetach, they found there was a very, very precious jewel, which was left, I guess, in some old saddle, which came along with the donkey. So they came to Shimon Shetach, and they were ecstatic, because he now had this precious jewel for which he could support himself effortlessly for the rest of his life. And according to the strict letter of the law, which Yerushalmi is discussing there, if a non-Jew loses an object, you don't have to give it back to him. You don't have to. You can give it back to him because, again, it comes back to this concept of not restoring a lost loan unless it's demanded. Since it's not a demandalized object, you don't have to technically restore it. So Shimon ben Shetach said to the students, did the non-Jew know that this was in the saddlebag? They said, no, of course he didn't know. Mm-hmm. So he said, give it back. So he said, but that's not that lawful. Why would you give it back? You can sustain yourself the rest of life. So he says, very powerful language about Yerushalmi. He says, Shimon ben Shetach said, do you think I'm a barbarian? You think it's better that I should remain poor my entire life, and this non-Jew should say, blessed is the God of Rabbi Shimon ben Shetach. In other words, I'm not here in order to make money, in order to make my life easy for myself. I'm here to serve God and represent what an ideal ethical person does, in order to demonstrate how a person is supposed to live their life. And that's how a person sanctifies God's name. So therefore, he refused to keep it, and he made sure that the non-Jew got the jewel back. So that is the standard of ethics one is supposed to adhere to. And I know it's hard in this day and age, I'm talking about myself, because there's so many things which are accepted in American society and as we're cutting, you know, where you cut corners and it takes advantage of loopholes and stuff like that. As we talked about the jury past few days, there are many, many, many gray areas, and I'm sure in the course of our series we'll come up with many other ones as well. But the guideline, what we're supposed to remember is there's halacha, in the strict letter of the law, and then there is demonstrating refined, elevated, and holy behavior. And the real thing one is supposed to aim for in the world is not to download as many songs for free as possible, but rather to be as refined and ethical as possible. Yeah.
I accept the distinctions in the gray areas and all of that, and I don't have a problem dealing with that or in that conversation. But where I'm particularly troubled when there's one law for the interaction between a Jew and another Jew and another law between a Jew and another, I find that offensive. I think that the halakha making any distinction is clearly Chilul Hashem, and I think has led to anti-Semitism and to hatred of Jews over the years. And I just think the Orthodox community does a major disservice by not standing up and saying, this is wrong and we don't believe this. And all the rules that are appropriate for Jew to Jew are appropriate for Jew to non-Jew. I don't see how we can function in this society if the distinction that the rabbi made was the right one to return the jewel, but that his students thought that, you know, because it came from a non-Jew instead of a Jew, one would behave differently. I can't warm up.
That's halacha.
It's hard to deal. It's interesting. It's more above a comma. Marba Kama speaks about this in the text that says that once they were, the non-Jews came to the Jews, it's a strange Gemara, but it's what it says, non-Jews came to the Jews and said, is it true that if your ox gores our ox, that you're exempt from paying, which is how halacha would be the case. And they said, yes, it's true. That is true. And there was a tremendous, you know, backlash. I don't remember exactly what it was, but it was a significant backlash in the Gemara discussed there. And they're Rishonim, like the Meiri, who say, when medieval scholars, that even though that was halacha, it only applied to non-Jews of the time who were not civilized, who were barbarian, who didn't accept the seven mitzvahs of the seven Noahide laws. But it certainly is not relevant in our day and age when people are properly religious and monotheistic, so then the same halacha applies to non-Jews as to Jews. But the Miri is not the only opinion which exists in that Gemara. And the question, one of the Achronim, one of the later sources asked the Marshal, the Shlomo Luria, he says that from the 17th century, he says, why couldn't they just lie? Why did they just say, you know, no, the halacha is the same. Why would they get themselves into trouble by saying the truth when they could have just dissembled and said, you know, the halacha is precisely the same for Jews and for non-Jews? And the Marshal says an amazing thing. He says that one is not, from this we see, he says, there is no other explanation. From this we see that one is not allowed to falsify Torah law, even under pain of death. Meaning, even though they could have suffered tremendous backlash, including death, nevertheless, they would have to answer truthfully when asked the question directly. So, it's possible not to give shir on things like this. That's one alternative. But the alternative I chose, because I think it's the better alternative, is to give a shir and say what the law is and what a higher level of functioning is and be honest about it. Because if I'm not honest, then you'll never know when I'm telling the truth or just being apologetic. So I can't change, even if I agree with you in principle, based on the Gemara in the Rishon B'Mitzvah, which I quoted before, that one should adhere to an equal standard, not a higher standard, for non-Jews, and there's certainly precedent for that, I have to be honest and tell you what the strict letter of the law is.
But then what are you implying? Is that what Hashem told us? Is not the ideal, not the best?
No, it's certainly, yeah, that's correct. Hashem made levels. The levels are for simple people, the levels for more refined people. The reality is that the Jewish nation consists, like any other nation, of many levels of functioning. There are people who function on higher levels, people who function on lower levels. And halacha is the minimum common denominator. That's true. The halacha is not supposed to be taken as the final and ultimate level of functioning as a human being in society. It's a baseline, not the end line. Okay, on that serious note, I guess we'll stop for today.
One more quick question. What if a person can't buy but is publicly available? Like, for instance, let's say a TV show that hasn't been put on DVD. Let's say old TV show, right? So if that's on TV, or you download it online that someone recorded off of TV, and you're unable, there is no option to buy it. And it's publicly available on the airway. It's
been totally legal. Just
so would that be, like, off the halakha, would that be a problem? Because you're not making any of this money.
That goes back really to the whole question of what you can record on a
DVR.
Right. So I think that for personal use, they were not, you know.
So if I download it online for personal use.
And don't distribute it.
And don't distribute it.
I'm just saying that we find a DVR off.
The person who I downloaded from is the one who's got it.
Maybe so if it was on Nick at Night, you'd be allowed to record it.
Just so I don't happen to have a TV. I don't happen to be awake at the same time.
I remember
then they have TiVo.
So
someone's providing it. If I'm just downloading it from him, even though he really should have distributed it, I could have set up a TV somewhere to record it.
Yeah.
But if the show's on DVD,
I'm actually going back to New York.